You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today. Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
You were doing satire up against an authoritarian government and then risking everything by turning it into a TV show. And it wasn't just any TV show. There's 80 million people in Egypt and 30 million people were watching your TV show. And you left being a heart surgeon at age 37 to do that.
Yes.
First question I have is, when you stopped being a doctor to do YouTube videos, was your wife upset?
Well, it didn't happen this way. I didn't just like switch from medicine into YouTube videos. What happened was that during the revolution, I was a regular doctor who went down to the streets to treat the people who were wounded and injured in the clashes against the pro-government forces. I didn't have entertainment in my mind. I didn't have YouTube in my mind. But every day that I would go back home, I would see the state-run media and see how they skewed the truth, how they spread fake news and lies and rumors and brainwashed the masses, and I was upset.
You had the most popular show out there. What was it, do you think, that kind of made you stand apart from the other shows?
The way that they were running the media was very stupid. And what happened was I made fun of this, and I think people needed this. I think people needed someone to speak about this.
Because it's so tense.
Yes.
And you're almost providing permission to relieve the tension.
Exactly. And the videos caught fire. I thought maybe 10,000 people would watch, and then there were millions watching.
So I am so excited to have Bassem Youssef. There's so many things about your background. I almost don't even know where to start the intro, but you're the ideal example of someone who's completely recreated your life and career several times and made enormous successes out of it each time. But that's only the beginning. So time, sorry for the long intro. Time made you one of the 100 most influential people in the world in 2013. That's just a start. But essentially, you were a heart surgeon. Then you became in Egypt. Then around the time of the Arab Spring, so-called revolution, you started doing YouTube videos about it. They got millions and millions of views. You switched careers to comedy. You got a TV show that got tens of millions of viewers a week. Then eventually, I mean, you were considered the Jon Stewart of Egypt. Then eventually, due to problems with the government in Egypt, you moved here to America, and now you're recreating yourself again. You have a podcast that you just started, Remade in America. Is that? I'm so happy to have you on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
I mean, I feel like the intro doesn't do it justice because, like, here someone could say, oh, you made some YouTube videos, then you got a TV show. And it kind of is just like this nice little thing, like, oh, I did some sketches and now it's a TV show. But you were like doing satire up against an authoritarian government and kind of on the run and then risking everything by turning it into a TV show. And it wasn't just any TV show. There's 80 million people in Egypt and 30 million people were watching your TV show. And now you're here.
Yeah.
And you left being a heart surgeon at age 37 to do that.
Yes.
First question I have is, when you stopped being a doctor to do YouTube videos, was your wife upset?
Well, it didn't happen this way. I didn't just like switch from medicine into YouTube videos. What happened was that during the revolution, I was a regular doctor who went down to the streets and to fix people's wounds, to treat the people who were wounded and injured in the clashes against the pro-government forces. I didn't have entertainment in my mind. I didn't have YouTube in my mind. But every day that I would go back home, I would see the state-run media and see how they skewed the truth, how they spread fake lies, fake news and lies and rumors and brainwashed the masses, and I was upset.
And you know, I want to mention, because I forgot to mention this in the intro, but you're sort of touching on it. A lot of this you describe in your excellent book, which I encourage everyone to read, Revolution for Dummies, how you were going into Tahrir Square, where a lot of the revolution, where a lot of the protests were happening, and you wanted to help people. You were bringing food. You, of course, were bringing your medical services, and the army or the thugs or the, you know, who are the pro-government forces were stopping you. But then you took a risk. Like, you had to get there somehow, and people were getting hurt there.
Yes.
Like, how did you get to the center of things so you could help people, and were you afraid of getting beaten?
There was a safe passage for doctors to go in and try to help the people. So we kind of, that was secured by the revolutionaries. And I did that almost every day, bring in medical supplies and try to fix the wounds and try to heal the people.
What wounds were there? Like, what was happening?
There was like all kinds of cut wounds, broken wounds. There were like, there's a lot of eye doctors that were on site because a lot of people were hurt having shots in their eyes. And it was a very, very brutal. It was like a war zone.
As a heart doctor, though, does that give you enough? I mean, this is how naive I am about medicine, but as a heart doctor, does that give you enough general skills to help kind of the wounds that could, the many various wounds that could occur
basically,
a battle situation?
We were doing that kind of like a first aid thing, you know, and anything that was specialized would triage it to go to the nearest hospital. But I didn't go there to perform heart surgery, just like simple stitches and to stitch wounds and to have to heal their cuts. That kind of...
What was the worst you had to heal?
The worst is like a very... very bad deep wound in the neck. Thank God it did not hit any deep arteries or veins. But that was like a very long kind of like, I think it took like kind of 32 stitches or something.
So later on, I'm going to ask you about kind of the political context of revolution versus pro-government, not only in Egypt, but zooming out globally and your view on that. But I want to start first with kind of the career stuff. So you're doing this, you have some friends that want you to, and you're noticing kind of the fake news slant that's happening in the government controlled media. You have some friends who are encouraging you to do a YouTube video. What sort of happened next?
So I did the YouTube videos while I was waiting actually for my papers to arrive from Cleveland, because I was accepted to start a pediatric heart surgery fellowship in Cleveland.
Cleveland Heart Clinic?
No, in the Rainbow Hospital for Children, because Cleveland, at that time, Cleveland Clinic didn't have pediatric heart surgery. So I was accepted in that hospital, the other hospital, and I was just waiting for the H-1 visa to arrive. And then the revolution happened, and then after we got rid of the 30-year-old, the dictator that was there for 30 years, Mubarak, I started to do the videos. And I didn't really think anything about the videos. I didn't leave medicine. I was just like, I'm just killing time until my papers arrive. And the videos caught fire. I thought maybe 10,000 people would watch, and then there were millions watching.
How did they describe like that very first video, and B, what's your theory on, you know, obviously many people create great YouTube videos, some catch fire, most don't. What's your theory on why yours caught fire? But first, describe that very first video.
The video is basically satirizing how the state-run media were very creative in telling people how don't go down to the streets. They were like using all kinds of lies. They were like, there are mujahideen, there are terrorists, there are people having sex, all kind of like stupid lies.
So you didn't obviously just say these are lies. Like, how did you use the
techniques of satire? You would get, it's kind of like I was very influenced by the Daily Show style. So it was like video coming back to comment on it, creating a narrative, over-the-shoulder pictures. It was that kind of style. Like it's a very knocked off version of the Daily Show.
And you know, this is, satire is almost hand given to you here, as opposed to, let's say, in America, where it's, I feel like it's, I don't want to say it's hard to do satire, but you were kind of, you have these almost fundamentalists or serious fundamentalists who are on the pro-government side saying, there's sex happening at the protests. That's
but these funny. But these were not even Islamists. They were like, you know, because the government was not Islamist. When you say fundamentalists, basically the pro-regime, the radical pro-regime nationalistic people. And the way that they want to alienate people, there's sex. There are boys and girls dancing. There are people having sexual relationship. It's like, that's an amazing marketing for the Tahrir Square.
Yeah,
that's why more people would go.
I feel like that's a slam dunk for satire. Like they kind of pitched you an easy pitch in baseball terms.
Exactly. Oh yeah, because it was the way that they were running the media was very stupid. And what happened was I made fun of this, and I think people needed this. I think the reason, it was not just like the video was good or bad. I think people needed someone to speak about this.
Because it's so tense.
Yes.
And you were almost providing a way, you were almost providing permission to relieve the tension.
Exactly.
Like, so people could share the video to their cousin and say, look, it's okay to, this guy's explaining how ridiculous it is, and it's kind of funny.
Yes, exactly.
And so what do you think happened? Was there kind of a big personality that started retweeting or sharing your video?
No, it was the most organic, democratic spread of an idea. There was no big personality doing it. They were like just like regular people. As if there was a feeling that like we own this now. We can actually push what we want as content, not waiting for the government to tell us what to push or not.
So people were just watching this video and spreading it to their
friends.
Spreading
it, and then in a couple of weeks, there's millions, and then 5 million. From 10,000 to 5 million.
At what point, literally at what number, did you realize, my life might have just changed?
No, I didn't really think about that. There was not like really a point where I thought my life has changed, but what the trigger was when networks started calling. Saying,
and it was pretty quick that they were calling.
By the second week, they were calling.
Is that because nobody had made a video in Egypt that got like 5 million views before?
No. It was not about the numbers. It was about, for the first time, people saw someone speaking truth to power.
But that's an interesting thing. Because in the U.S., networks don't call when you speak the truth. Networks call when you have the numbers. And so you're actually saying in Egypt, the network's call because you had an opinion, a bias that was different than the other channels.
No. I was answering the question, why did people watch? So I said, this is where the numbers came from. So when people say, networks call whoever is popular.
Yeah.
And at that time, that was popular.
And so, but they saw that it was popular like right away. Like, oh my gosh,
yes.
This is huge. This is like the Gangnam Style of Egypt.
Yes. That was just like catching fire. And then people, I didn't know by then if I would actually be good as a TV host. I didn't have any experience. So I found myself signing the contract for my first TV show in the same day that the H-1 visas came from Cleveland. And
so now you had a decision to make.
I had a decision to make. Should I pursue a life of empty fame and money, or should I continue healing people's hearts? So I chose the money. But no, the thing is, like, even at that time, I didn't quit medicine. I put medicine on hold. Or not just medicine hold, the travel to Cleveland, the travel to the United States at all. And I continued actually performing my duties as a doctor in as a faculty member in Cary University Hospital.
How did your colleagues feel about your new, like, obviously you were starting to be recognized in the street.
Yes.
How did your doctors feel?
It was a little bit very uncomfortable when you're doing rounds with a professor leading the round and you're one of the young doctors there and you get all the attention from the patients. So that was very uncomfortable.
Were they jealous?
Some of them were welcoming, some of them had some insecurity problems.
Like, did anyone sit you down and say, listen, you really need to focus on being a better doctor, not doing this?
I heard that. I heard that. And but I promised my mom, who was a typically Middle Eastern mom, that I would continue being a doctor on the side.
In your book, Revolution for Dummies, you make a joke, I think it was in the book, or maybe it was in an interview, but I think it was in the book, that you were, you know, you went to a good school, you were a heart surgeon, you were almost like a good Jewish son.
Yes, exactly.
And now obviously you become the black sheep in a Jewish family if you go from medicine to comedy.
So my mom's condition to continue to with the entertainment is to keep the medicine. So I kept it for a year and a half, but then I couldn't, because not just like my schedule was becoming crazy, is because the Muslim Brotherhood, after they arrived into power, they started harassing me and kind of like pressure me into my workplace. So I didn't want to give them.
How so? I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm an interrupter.
So they kind of like started to question, you know, there's like, whenever you work in a government facility, there's so many ways to, you know, to get you, especially if the government, you're making fun of the government owns the facility now. So they started, so I was like on a leave of absence. So they started to investigate the leave of absence. So I said to, you know what, I'm not going to give them anything to pressure me. So I resigned. And that was kind of officially me leaving medicine. But so I continue. So to answer your initial question, when did you leave medicine to do YouTube videos? No, that actually happened a year and a half ago into my show.
So you sort of tongue in cheek said, do I spend a lifetime, you know, saving lives with medicine, or do I do empty fame and money with comedy? It's not quite true, because your videos and show were obviously having an impact on the way the citizens of Egypt were viewing their country and their government. You were making, you were instrumental in changing the way people thought about what was happening in their country. I mean, what was it, like 40% of the country were watching your show.
Yeah.
So it's not, that's not empty fame. You were actually making a difference and having an impact. So I'll call you, I appreciate the tongue-in-cheek, but, you know, you can argue saving lives on one hand, but also maybe informing tens or hundreds of millions of people over time on what's happening in this very dire situation is also meaningful and impactful, and it's not just about the money and so on.
That's why we work in satire. We make fun of everything, even of our life decisions. And then I continue with the show. And after a year of the first season, that was a very small show, pre-recorded in a small studio. Then I said at the end of the season, I don't want to do this anymore. I want this to be a big live audience show with a real theater. And this is something never happened in Egypt. And everybody ridiculed me. They said, it's never going to happen. It's going to be big budget. You're going to lose money. Nobody's going to buy this. And I said, I don't care. I don't want to do the easy stuff anymore. So I traveled to New York, and I met the team for the Daily Show. Somehow I persisted that I want to meet them, and they accepted that I will shadow them for a couple of days. And I said in my mind, maybe I'll snap a picture with Jon Stewart. And I got more than this, because John invited me to his office, and I thought that would be a nice 5-minute chat, continued for an hour. And then a couple of minutes after that meeting, the booker, the one who handled the guest, told me, would you like to be a guest on the show? And of course I said yes. And that was the beginning of a wonderful friendship. And then I appeared a total of 4 times on Jon Stewart's show. And I told him on that day, I will make you proud. I'm going to go back to Egypt. I'm going to create the biggest show with live audience like you. And I will invite you to that theater. And a year after, he came. He was in Egypt on my show to support me. And he was a guest on my show. And he saw my theater. He was very proud of me. He was very proud of my team.
And I mean, did he, I'm sure this must have been an incredible experience. Like, this was your hero, your inspiration in comedy, for your YouTube videos, for your show. Did he consider even producing your show in Egypt?
He cannot produce a show in Egypt. This system is different. Mm-hmm. This is something we take money from the network and we do it. It's just, that he will not get involved in something like this. That was a totally different ball game. He came after the show has already established.
Again, when you were making this shift, this change, what self-doubt did you have? Like, obviously you had put in, you know, 15 years studying and doing medicine, and you had just been doing a YouTube videos. Admittedly, they were
actually
very 19
popular. 19 years. I did 19 years of studying and working as a medical doctor. And then I do this, and the self-doubt was, am I good enough to do this? And I have no experience. I have no history. Why am I doing this? I always felt that I'm undeserving.
And how do you overcome that? Because obviously you never overcame it, but obviously you did.
I never overcame it.
And do you think that's a benefit? Do you think you would do better if you overcame that?
I don't know. I always live with a continuous self-doubt. If I'm good enough to do this, because even when I come here to America, now I do comedy in English and I do stand up, and I always ask myself why would I actually succeed while there are other people doing it for 20 years, and I don't know if I'm good enough to do it. I don't have the experience. I don't have the training, and so why am I doing this?
So you do though have. So this segues into an interesting thing, which is, you know, I'm sure you've read Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers, where he talks about, okay, you need 10,000 hours of experience in something before you're among the best in the world. And when you refer to stand-up or even being a talk show host, I mean, many of those guys or women have put in 10,000 hours of experience. Like Jon Stewart, before he started The Daily Show, he had already been 10,000 hours doing stand-up, doing shows, being involved in a variety of projects, and then finally he does The Daily Show. And what do you think of that? Do you think the 10,000 hours is necessary to find your voice as the greatest?
I mean, I don't know. It sounds credible, mm-hmm. but that's what makes me scared, because I didn't put out that much time. And that's why I always feel that I am undeserving, because out of nothing, I became a TV host of the biggest show in Egypt in history. Not just in Egypt, in the Middle East. When you have 40 million people watching you, this is the most successful thing that ever happened. You always ask, what did I put into it?
And what skills that you had that you were bringing into it, and whether they were skills or talents is something we could talk about, but what skills did you bring into the talk show, even that first season where you were getting over, you know, 10 million viewers? What made you the best?
I don't know. I'm really struggling with that question.
Is it because you were the only one? I don't believe that.
No, there was other people. But the thing is, like, I always wanted to have a message. Because there are other people who are funnier than me. There were other people who are even more experienced than me. But maybe the only thing that I wanted the show to matter. I wanted to see, all right, we're not going to just do easy jokes. We are going to have a message every time. We will make people laugh and then go home thinking.
So give me an example of what's like an easy joke that you could have done in Egypt at the time, and then you taking it and pushing it a little further so it would have a message but still keep its humor.
So there's two incidences, one under the Muslim Brotherhood and one under the military.
The Muslim Brotherhood was...
We need to explain the history. After the revolution, the Islamists got into power, the Muslim Brotherhood. And then after a year, they kind of alienated people from democracy. And then the army came in presenting themselves as a savior. People welcomed them. That was actually a military coup. And then the military ruled, that's still ruling right now.
This is from Morsi to Sisi.
Yes, from Morsi to Sisi. So under the military, they... announced that they found a cure for AIDS. This is the most ridiculous invention ever. And the invention looked ridiculous. The guy who announced it, the general, looked ridiculous. And there were so many easy jokes there. But what we did is that we took that to hold the military accountable, to call them out. And we did something very simple, that after each show, even if we're not talking about the AIDS machine, we will put a countdown clock reminding people about the deadline that the military said that they're going to release the cure. And people were waiting for this moment every single time. This is something very simple.
So like the easy joke...
The easy joke is like, oh, look, that's so ridiculous. Look at him. You know, yeah. It's like, look what he just said. But
you could have said his only experience was beating up people in Tahrir Square.
Yeah.
And suddenly... You know, he has this invention for AIDS.
Yeah, but that's very easy. Yeah. But then under the Muslim Brotherhood, they always made the statement that they are much purer than us as Muslims. So we just equated them with Nazis. And that was the bigger idea. Because you can always like take a word and make fun of the word. But what is the overarching idea of what they're saying? So with the Islamist, it's like they are purer than us. And they are a superior race. With the army, we cannot do any wrong. We can do no wrong. We are perfect.
Well, why would they take that platform of claiming to be perfect and pick something like AIDS? Like, oh, we found a cure for AIDS. Like, why would... I've never heard a government like declare that.
The arrogance. They think they can get away with anything.
But why didn't they just say, oh, we found a cure for the common cold?
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because people don't realize a lot that many dictatorships are very incompetent and they're stupid because they are used to the fact that it's a one-way conversation and people don't really ask or question them.
So this questioning, so let me pose an idea and see what you think of it. To some extent, you know, you're 19 years in medicine. Medicine is a lot about skepticism. So you look at a patient, you don't yet know what's wrong with them. They say something, you examine the body and the data, maybe suggest something else, and it's a matter of give and take, figuring out what is the actual problem. And you push yourself to find the right problem so you could find the right solution. And maybe you borrowed from those 10,000 hours of being skeptical in the medical field to be able to be skeptical where the patient is the country itself, and the proposed solutions often seem ridiculous. Mm. And maybe that same skill set somehow you borrowed from into your satire.
Maybe, but like at the end of the day, comedy and satire is all also about the delivery and experience on stage, and that I never had. Mm-hmm. So you can have a good skeptical mind, but does that make you a great speaker or a great comedian or a great stand-up? And this is why coming back to the idea of like, am I deserving or not?
I have to say, Airbnb has changed my life. I just love staying in Airbnbs. Like in about a month, I'm going to Cocoa Beach, which is right next to Cape Canaveral. I'm going to watch some rocket launches. I'm going to, of course, be staying in a very nice Airbnb on the beach. And it's just such a great experience. Like, the whole world is available to us now because of Airbnb. But whenever I'm at an Airbnb, I always realize, you know, the home that I left to come to this Airbnb, I could be making money on that right now by hosting and being an Airbnb myself. So, and I've known people, I had a friend who basically, you know, made a living from turning his home into an Airbnb. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, you do have an Airbnb there. And it can easily fit into your lifestyle, and it's a great way to earn some money. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours. And they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Imagine bold, naturally aged Tillamook cheddar slices melting over a burger. Eating handfuls of thick-cut cheddar shreds straight from the bag. Taking a bite out of an irresistibly bold block of extra sharp cheddar cheese. We know you want to get back to streaming, but wasn't it nice to daydream about cheese for a bit? Tillamook Cheddar. Extraordinary dairy.
So tell me, like, when you were on stage, and again, you had the most popular show out there, so it doesn't matter that there were other shows, you obviously had something. What was it, do you think, in your delivery or in your approach that kind of made you stand apart from the other shows?
I think people didn't just watch us every week for the easy laughs, because as I said, there are much people were fine, I think, had a better sense of humor, but they were watching us every week because they were waiting for us to tell them what is going on in the country and what is our point of view. They actually reached for the show for guidance, which is interesting and flattering, but also very dangerous, because you have all of this responsibility laid on you of people wanting you to be the changer, but we're not. We're just like telling them what's happening.
Well, and even Jon Stewart would always, when people would say, hey, I get all my news from The Daily Show, Jon Stewart was always careful to say, listen, we're a comedy show first. We're not a news show.
Yes.
Even though the reality is, many people got their news from The Daily Show.
And the thing is, and as I said, this is when people get frustrated with their politicians and with the news media, they turn to comedians, because we don't ask you for anything other than giving you a good time and of laughter. But the danger is that people think too much of satirist and comedian and think that they have the answer, and that's very dangerous.
Well, it's a gray area going back thousands of years. Like, just think the mythology around the court jester. The court jester is supposed to be the only one in the court who can tell the king the truth. Mm-hmm. And the king's, whether the king listens or kills him, I don't know, but that's supposedly the jester's role, and that's the role you kind of played in Egypt. You were Egypt's jester.
Yes.
And so, again, in terms of delivery, what skills did you have to learn to how did you improve? I'm sure you watched your video each week and studied it. How did you improve to improve your delivery? What were some of the skills you learned in the very first season while you were doing this?
To slow down.
Yeah.
To feel and enunciate the words more. To listen to the audience.
What does that mean?
To listen to the room. Because, and this is actually, by the way, it's a continuous, because now when I'm doing stand-up in English, which is a total rewiring of the brain. Because you see, Jon Stewart started as a stand-up comedian.
Way back.
And most of these hosts that you see right now, they started as stand-up comedians. Most of them. And then they became hosts. I never did stand-up comedy in Egypt. I, from doctor to host, and then from host, coming here doing stand-up comedy in English, not my language. Never did stand-up comedy in Arabic. Now I'm coming here doing stand-up in English to an audience that's not mine, or the language that's not mine. So the disruption that's happening in my brain, trying to overcome this. So I learned to be comfortable with the silence, to overcome the silence, be comfortable with the pauses. The pauses itself are statements. And to bring people into your world instead of being frustrated if your jokes are not working.
I want to get to the stand-up in a second, because that's part of how you're recreating yourself in America. And I would argue stand-up is one of the most difficult skills out there. Now, I'm talking to a heart surgeon, which I'm sure is an incredibly difficult
skill. I would say it's really up there.
And I myself have been doing stand-up in this very club that we're doing this podcast in. And it's one of the most fascinating reinventions of my life after many reinventions. But it seems with you, let's talk about stand-up in a second. I want to continue with the journey that you took. You went from first season to then show with a live audience. I guess you wanted the live audience because you get that visceral feedback as you're doing your satire.
Oh, yeah, big time. Big
was that
time.
A big difference?
Oh, huge difference. The energy that you get from the audience was just like incredible, like night and day.
And, you know, there's something interesting too about having an audience for a TV show like yours, which is not, the audience is not random. Like when you do stand-up at a comedy club, the audience is random. Most often, they're not there to see you. They might not even know who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that saying it, I want to just mention to people listening to this, you have 10 million Twitter followers. You have millions of Instagram followers. I'm sure on every social media platform, you have millions of followers. So people around the world know you, but here in the United States, probably not everyone knows who you are. And so when you do stand up in a club, not everyone knows who you are. You kind of have to convince them from start, every time you go up, like me, find me funny, find my point of view interesting, and so on. But when you have a live audience at a show in Egypt, people who are in the audience, they've almost pre-selected themselves to, you have an audience that likes you. You don't have to educate them. Mm-hmm. So to some extent, the audience there is different than the audience here, because they're more inclined to like what you're saying and laugh at it and give you that energy and help you figure out that feedback, how to navigate it. But how did you see your delivery changed because you started to appreciate the silence and your pauses. What were you learning from the silence of the audience?
That you need to be comfortable with the silence, because comedians here usually get nervous when there's silence in the room. They need the laughter. So I learned that you need to slow down instead of rushing to the next joke, because that will actually spoil two jokes.
Yeah. And I think, like you said, when there's silence, often comedians get nervous and speed up. Yeah. So doing the opposite of that is important.
And also I learned that maybe they are silent because they're listening to you. They're not vocal, but maybe they appreciate what you're saying. So at least you want to tell yourself this, especially if you're talking about something deeper. So I think, not rushing to the next joke, because that would just spoil the whole set.
Well, a lot of times there could be silence for three reasons, maybe. There's silence because they don't like you.
Mm-hmm.
There's silence because they think you're funny, but they're smiling inside. It's not like a belly laugh kind of joke. Or there's silence because you've said something that's incredibly tense and they're still waiting for the tension to break and then they're going to laugh.
Yes.
And you kind of have to figure that out in real time. And did you find that a lot on your show, that, okay, they're silent right now, but I just said something really, inciting and insightful, and I just need to figure out how to break that tension so they can laugh?
Well, with the TV show, it's going to be difficult because you're following a script. There's a teleprompter and there's a queue for videos that are coming up. So it is a little bit difficult to actually break out of that. In stand-up, it's freestyling. But I think we just have to be confident in our material and know that this will work.
And you got that confidence because you were in such a high stakes situation. This is the lives of the entire country of Egypt and beyond, really, because the Arab Spring was hitting every country in the Middle East, but also in the years after that, kind of what was happening in Egypt was being looked at by many countries, how revolution was working, and you were kind of the voice of the other side. And so it was important what you were doing, and it was high stakes, and you could always fall back on your message. I feel like in America, there's not as much of a message to fall back on. There's a billion philosophers / comics who have an opinion either on for Trump or against Trump, and does America really need one more philosopher / comic is unclear. And there's tons of talk shows, and again, they have their biases, each one of them. But you were the only one in Egypt, and that must be a difference you feel between Egypt and America.
Yes, because America is kind of saturated in that space. Anybody can start a blog right now or a vlog and do it. But in Egypt, it was a very, very polarized country, and I was not with anybody. I was not with the Islamists or the military. So people thought that, all right, maybe he has a point.
Right. Although everybody tried to peg you, you for a while, you were with the owner of the station was a billionaire Christian. So people thought you were kind of a tool of that guy. People would like anything.
They will always find that there's an ulterior motive of what I'm doing. It's for self-interest money. You're hating the Islamists because you are a secret atheist and you hate or a secret Christian even. And even I would say I was called a secret Jew. And
Your wife's Palestinian, and
it doesn't matter. Your wife Palestinian, so you must have some ulterior political motives. And then I was against the military. It's you are a traitor. You are actually being paid by America. they always find a way that doesn't have to do anything with what you think or what your opinions are in order to bring you down. This is how you discredit people. So instead of the Trump supporters, instead of actually dealing with the news, they say it's fake news.
Right.
You know, so they kind of discredit from the beginning. These are fake news. These are like unfair, whatever.
But the only reason you were being attacked is because you were had a strong enough influence that you were a threat.
Yes.
So one, you know, to quote my podcast producer Steve Cohen, when you're a threat, you're a target, and you're becoming a target, a target to the point where eventually the government started to take more. They started closing in on you.
Yes.
You were getting sued.
And this happened both under two regimes. So under the Islamist, I ended up having a warrant for my arrest, and I had to actually be interrogated by the general prosecutor.
Were you scared?
No.
You didn't see, this is Egypt sort of in between, I feel, in the sense that if you were in China being interrogated, or if you were in some other very authoritarian regime, they might take you in for interrogation and no one would ever see you again, no trial, nothing.
I was kind of focused on like doing a good show at that time. Mm-hmm. And when under the Islamists tried to stop the show, but they couldn't because they were not strong enough. Then the military came, and I have to say I admit that I was scared, not because of what they can do to me, but what could they do to the people around me, because my producer, they took his father and his brother in, and they very hostile, and they stopped my show right there in the beginning. They stopped my show twice. They jammed my satellite signal because they control the communication.
But again, why couldn't they just throw you in jail and shut you up?
They wanted to appear, because at that time the military wanted to gain its legitimacy in front of the world. Now they don't care, but at that time they wanted to prove that they were not a coup. So they want to kind of make it as devious as possible and underhanded as possible. So it's like, oh, I mean, it's not us. I mean, something happened to the satellite. We didn't stop his show. It is financial problems between him and the network. And they are the one who are pressuring the network. And it took them a year to kind of like effectively shut me down, because now they were more comfortable. They were having now the military aid from America. America is acknowledging them. Europe is acknowledging them. So they thought that they can now move on and completely shut down the media. So it took them a year, the military. And then they came after me because they know they can get away with it. And this is where I escaped.
So you escaped specifically at one point. There was a lawsuit. You lost. There was lots of things at stake.
Yeah, and I didn't lose because I didn't have a good position. It was totally politicized verdict. And it was a financial verdict. You see, this is the way they get people there. They don't get people because of freedom of expression. In Egypt, we have a very famous and very popular soccer player. He's like our LeBron James, basically. And he's retired, and he was known to be a little bit sympathetic with the previous government, and they got him for tax evasion, and they confiscated all his money, and he had to escape. So this is how they get you.
So when you moved to America, so during one, you know, they were closing in on you, they were coming to get you, whether it was your money or you or your family, whatever. You moved to America, you had 90 minutes to basically pack up and get to the airport. You were even afraid at that point they would have already put you on a no-fly list, but fortunately,
yes,
you got lucky.
Yeah, because it was just like a couple of hours after the verdict, so they didn't have time.
So you flew out to Dubai, essentially the closest place you could get to.
Yes.
And in Dubai, once you were in Dubai, you felt safe? You didn't feel that Egypt's claws would get
no,
to Dubai?
No, I didn't feel 100% safe, because they still have communications, and I don't know if I'm going to be deported or anything. But like, I felt like relatively safer.
Were you able to pull your money out? Were you already
some of it? Yes, but at the end, I felt that like if I'm going to stay in that area, I'm not going to be able to be free to say what I want.
So you moved to the United States. There's a documentary about you.
Tickling Giants. By an amazing Seth Exler, who was a producer at The Daily Show for 10 years. And she followed me since the day I went into the office of Jon Stewart.
And again, I highly encourage people to watch that. And now you start this new podcast, Remade in America. And what's What are your challenges? What's you're the most famous person in Egypt. You get to America, you walk down the street, people don't recognize you. Where are your 10 million Twitter followers? They're not on Hollywood Boulevard.
They're not.
And there's 200,000 podcasts, including this one. And there's 5,000 working stand-up comics. There's you know, news and news/comedy related talk shows on every single channel, you know, going from the late night show on down. And you know, very, very good ones just recently started on Netflix, but just basically every outlet has kind of politically oriented satire news shows. You're doing stand up. Where do you see this is an amazing reinvention as well? Because how is it going?
Well, here's the thing. I had to deal with myself, and I need to acknowledge that the days of my shows in Egypt, where I was the biggest thing there, is behind me. This is a legacy, and I created this legacy, and the legacy will stay. And I will not make this be in the way of because you know that there's ego involved. You shouldn't let that ego be in the way of you trying to reinvent yourself here, because I'm here and I'm totally acknowledge the fact that I am here in a different playing field.
So you can't feel entitled.
I know. There's absolutely no entitlement. I don't expect doors to be open for me. I need to earn this. So when I do stand up, and when I'm trying material, I go to a small comedy club in Los Angeles. And when the announcers know me, and they say, I'm going to introduce and say, John Susan, and I don't say this. Just say, Bassem from Egypt. And I go there, what audience that haven't seen me, maybe haven't seen the Daily Show, and I need to earn my place there. I need to earn their approval. So I'm at the age of 44, two kids and a wife, I'm doing what 22 years old, young, struggling actors doing, waiting tables and trying to find their way into a new field, while I'm doing it as a disadvantage because English is not my first language too.
But are you doing stand-up to become a great stand-up comedian?
No.
Now, obviously you always want to improve, but, you know, what's... Do you have an outcome in mind? Like you want to, again, start a talk show?
I wish to host my own talk show as I did in Egypt. And I want it to be different. And stand-up is a great segue to do that. So maybe now I actually should follow the normal path instead of just like sprouting out as a host. I need to do things the right way. And I need to give it time and I need to work on myself and invest into my abilities and myself to be deserving.
Well, you know, on the one hand, I mean, of course I agree with you, like that's always a good thing. But again, there is something to be said by the fact that you were able to create, with competition, the number one comedy/satire/news show in Egypt.
But that's Egypt.
Right, but there are skills from there that you could bring here, which is what I see from you is this ability to push a little further than the easy. Like, we're doing this podcast above a comedy club, and I see the comedians there every night. The easy jokes make the crowd laugh. And there's a tendency, I think, for many comedians to get addicted to the easy jokes because it's an easy dopamine fix. Oh, I'll go up for 10, 15 minutes, get the crowd to laugh. No one can criticize me, and we'll see. But how do you find yourself, and you probably see the same thing when you go up. So how are you now trying to put, your skill, it seems to me, is to be able to, your skill at reinvention is to be able to push that, pick an area and push that one layer deeper where you become unique. Hmm. And how do you see yourself doing that in stand-up?
Well, I consider myself a little bit different from many of the comics because, first of all, I am not an Arab-American comedian. Because Arab-American comedians are essentially American.
Right. They get up stage, they make fun of their backgrounds, they make fun of their parents.
They were raised here, they were born here. I came fresh off the boat a couple of years ago from that area. So I am an Arab speaking to you in your language, telling you stuff about my people and how am I perceived here and how you are perceived in my country. And this duality creates an interesting mix. So I make fun of hypocrisy that I see in America, but also make fun of the hypocrisy that I see in the religious people and the people that come in politics in the Middle East. And I try to draw similarities between what you see here and see there.
Like, what's an example?
Well, you know, the whole idea about hypocrisy in religion. It's the same. Trump is very similar to some of our dictators, and how the gun supporters here are no similar for the patriotic voices and mouthpieces back in Egypt. And I speak about my life as an Arab Muslim immigrant here, being the usual suspect every time something happens here.
Do you find that? And by the way, that premise is always funny. The fact that every Muslim or Arab,
I have to explain myself. Why it's like? Why don't you speak? Why don't you speak louder? What do you want me to go up like Empire State and shout? What do you want me to do?
So, do you find that in your stand-up, and we'll talk about your podcast in a second also, but do you find that in your stand-up, crowds are less likely to laugh because they're not? It's not the standard set up punchline that they're used to in a comedy club, but you're able to get them kind of thinking a little more deeply because you're pointing out these similarities between, let's say, authoritarian governments and where we are now, you know, using satire.
Well, actually, I had a really good run in Joe's Pub because I think the stand-up was able to have the best of both worlds. We have really big laughs, but we also have parts where people are thinking, and the thinking creates tension, and then you end up with a big laugh. So it is quite like, I think one of the people at Joe's Pub used the word, this is a very loaded stand-up. Hmm. It's a very loaded stand-up. Like, and yesterday that there were like people from India, Indian directors that came from with my agents, and they said, I could not actually... I never lost focus for one. I was like there. I was paying attention for a whole hour. And this is what I like about it. It was loaded. It was full of ideas, and it was relevant, and it was more of a story and narrative, not separate jokes that doesn't relate to each other. There's a story that there is like an arc that you're creating between my journey from starting in Egypt, coming all the way here.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I'm 50. I've been doing stand-up for about 3 years. And like you say, I don't have the 20 years experience of many of the people who go up downstairs. But when they start at 22, they also don't have the life experience.
Yes.
So you're able to draw from the life experience. This very strange thing happened to me that I'm going to explain why it's strange. And that in itself is different and funny that they don't expect. Like, this is what you can expect as you grow older and observe, like, and if you have an odd kind of life, or if you have a life filled with reinvention and in high stakes situations, these sorts of things can happen, and they're loaded. Mm. And that's where some of the humor comes from. But the challenge, and just in terms of a craft level, is still turning it into the punchline.
Yes.
And
yes.
Do you run across that where you're like, oh, I've got this great story, but...
Well, the thing is, like, I have a story of someone who got persecuted for his jokes, and that's something unique. Mm-hmm. And you use that, and people would like to listen. I mean, there's a whole bit in my routine where I speak about the time when I was persecuted and interrogated for 6 hours. What is it like to interrogate a comedian for 6 hours, you know? So that is something that people would listen to, because they will never listen to it anywhere else.
So that's a funny premise.
Yes.
And often the best way to have a funny punchline is to start with a funny premise. But do you still find yourself working hard to create, you know, pushing that extra layer to come up with the funny punchline to that?
Yes, absolutely. It's a work in progress. It's the whole time, yes.
And then you also have your podcast. In fact, we've shared a couple of very interesting guests like Jordan Peterson and Sheila Nevins. And I'm sure there'll be others in the future. And how's it going in general? Like, how are you, you know, again, this is a total reinvention. You were number one in Egypt. Now you're here. How are you doing financially?
Well, it's fine. I mean, like, the public speaking is going well. I do a lot of lectures on public speaking, and that actually helped me. And I've got a lot of support of my agents. And I'm it's going well. I think I'm like everybody else in the entertainment business waiting for a big break. So I hope the big break will come. Maybe some executives and some networks say, all right, we need that voice right now because there's nobody from my part of the world is being represented.
Why not do the same thing you did in Egypt, which is essentially you chose yourself to create your first show. You did it on YouTube.
Because here the market is too saturated. Hmm. It's not going to be like an easy ride like what happened. I mean, I'm not saying that in Egypt it was easy, but it's just like, as you said, it's the content here is everywhere.
You feel here it's more important to get the blessing of some network executive.
Yes, because, or else you're just going to be like one of thousands of vloggers doing it. Hmm.
But at the same time, look at media in America. I mean, Netflix is spending $13 billion a year on original programming. They've got 200 shows up there. I don't even know 199 of the shows.
Yeah.
Like TV is also saturated.
I know, but like at least you get more visibility and you get the chance to have a show to speak your mind, and then you are into the competition, and then you prove yourself.
I see. So just getting your foot in the door.
Yes.
Pushing yourself to find that one layer mm-hmm. deeper that makes you different, and then you see what happens, and then you prove yourself.
Exactly.
So what are the, given that you've gone through this sort of reinvention several times, and again, in pretty high-stakes situations, it's not like you're switching from working at a grocery store to working in a shoe store. You're like, you know, going from being a doctor to being the voice against the government to being in America. So huge reinventions. What are some of the skills of reinvention that you feel you've carried from career to career?
I think being a doctor and being a nerd and being persistent is the most important thing.
What do you mean being a nerd?
Being a nerd is someone who is like persistent about knowing the knowledge and studying. So I study a lot.
And like for, let's say for stand-up, which I agree with you is kind of builds the building block of skills for talk show host or for many other things. What do you study to learn those skills?
Oh, all kinds of old stand-ups I can watch. And even George Carlin, old school. But right now, even when I in the car and I listen to SiriusXM, the comedy show, and I always listen. I listen to their pauses and where do they pause. I listen to an unexpected joke. I expected to like how they switch. Yeah,
like the reversals. Mm-hmm. Like you thought they were going down one way, they go down another way.
Yes.
You know, there's also various comics who are known more. Every comedian sort of known for their thing. Like some people are insult comics, some people are straight set up punchline, and some people are storytellers. Like Mike Birabiglia is a storytelling comic. He had a Netflix special. Mm. Gary Goldman is a storytelling style comic, and many of those might fit your style and approach. There's also a lot of political comics, but I think again we're almost saturated because of Trump. We've become saturated with political commentary.
Yes.
And, you know, just as a final thing, you know, revolution is interesting. Like, you can argue Mubarak, which everybody, and I know nothing, okay? I've never even been to Egypt. But you can argue that after 30 years of him being in power, there was some stability there. You were able to relatively safely grow up and build a career and do your thing. And then there's a revolution and suddenly it's the Islamists in control and the military in control. And this is kind of a worldwide phenomenon that change, while it always seems exciting, is not necessarily for the better, even if the prior situation was bad.
Let me answer you in a medical term.
Yeah.
This is kind of like if you having a very slow growing cancer, mm-hmm. but like I'm surviving, and then you interfere and there's complication. But you stay there and you want to make the body better. The thing is, having a cancer is not stability. The stability is only on the surface. And the reason why the revolution failed, not because of the revolution, is because the alternatives were killed. The alternative, the democratic secular alternatives were always put down by the dictators. They will always prop up the Islamists and the military, so that will be your only two options. So the thing is, this is not like the fault of a revolution. what we're having right now is because of the festering dictatorship and incompetence that happened under, not just under Mubarak 30 years, but the 30 years before him with the military coming to power. This is the result of him, not the, the revolution. The revolution is just, what they do is they lift the lid.
Well,
you're passing, like if you're walking over the sewers, you don't really smell, but there's a lid. It doesn't mean that there's not shit down there.
So, and you make the point in your book, Revolution for Dummies, that the Islamists and the military are often the same.
They're the same. And if there's any kind of like agreement, it will always be between these two on the behalf, on the expense of whatever liberal force is there.
And I wonder if it's because of just rising income inequality worldwide, you know, like in the Middle East, for instance, because of oil, becomes the poor class that doesn't have access to the resources of oil, and there's the upper classes, and then the corrupt classes. Does rising inequality ever have a solution that's peacefully resolved, other than through some sort of violent revolution backed by a religion to control the masses?
Well, inequality is always comes from the fact that there's enough resources in the world, but it's always the people who are in power, they want to sequester these resources for them. So they either do it in the name of religion or in the name of nationalism. So that you will always have this. And the only way to actually, look at Northern Europe. Northern Europe don't have that much resources. Germany have no resources, by the way, no natural resources. But it's because of transparency, accountability, and secularism. That's what makes people can share their resources, because now people have the power of accountability, like asking and questioning and accountability. Germany doesn't have the oil of Saudi Arabia or the gold and the diamonds of Africa. Germany is known to be a very poor resource country. They have nothing, but they have management. They know how to manage. Same with Japan. What are the natural resources of Japan? Other than fishing, nothing.
And then in America, you know, we start to see parallels just in the divide. You start to see parallels between this country and other more, you know, extreme countries. Do you think we're heading in that direction?
Or? No, the problem with America is not Trump or the rise of right wing. I think the power of America, the problem with America is more it's turning into more of an oligarchy. How you as a voter go in and you vote for a candidate, and then he goes and gets money from other lobbies, and that end up affecting their decision. So they end up not representing you; they're representing the people who give them money. So it's money that's running politics, which is very very disturbing.
So, Bassem Youssef, you have such a fascinating story. I hope you can come on the podcast again and we'll follow the journey. I just want to spell your name for the listeners. It's Bassem Youssef. Check out Remade in America, the podcast. I'm going to recommend Revolution for Dummies, the book.
And Tickling Giants.
Tickling Giants, the documentary. Just check this guy out. He's an important person to check out. I'm so glad you came on the show. Also, every time you Google your name, the John Stewart of Egypt always comes up. So you really did fascinating things, and your story of reinvention is inspiring. And I hope we keep following the story.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.